Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD 2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. There is so much happening on the Indianapolis local food scene right now, so we have lots to talk about today. First off, at the intersection of food and politics, we'll hear about a new menu at Marrow in Fountain Square. Marrow chef and restaurant partner John Adams, along with sous chef Myra Church and bartender Charlie Shoemaker, tell us about a new menu that spotlights the Middle Eastern and African countries affected by the recent White House travel ban. Today we'll also talk with Rob Caputo, executive director of the Brewers of Indiana Guild, about the state of craft beer in Indiana, and also about Winterfest, the group's super popular and sold-out craft beer fest that features more than 100 Hoosier breweries. And we'll wrap up our three-part series on local chocolatiers with a conversation with Julie Boljak of Chocolate for the Spirit. We'll hear what life's like for a chocolatier during the build-up to Valentine's Day, and we'll also talk with Julie about what prompted her to make a career change to focus on fine chocolate. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. It has been an eventful 2 weeks since the presidential inauguration. There was the January 21st Women's March on Washington, other marches around the country and here in Indianapolis, and most recently protests at airports over the White House travel ban that targets 7 Middle Eastern and African nations. But why are we talking about that here on Eat Drink Indie Radio? What do national politics have to do with local food? Well, those protests struck a chord with local chef John Adams of Marrow in Fountain Square, a restaurant that specializes in, as he puts it, global soul food, and he wanted to do something. Unable to participate in protests or demonstrations, he and his sous chef created a menu of dishes from the 7 countries targeted by the recent ban on travel. From a sorghum porridge dish from Sudan to a chicken dish from Yemen and a dessert from Syria, even a cocktail that traces the roots of the mint julep, the recipes, Adam says, are a way to learn about the areas, and he hopes some of the proceeds can help support a local organization that works with refugees. He and sous chef Myra Church and bartender Charlie Shoemaker explain how the menu came about.
Marrow represents a concept we call global soul food. We try to take a food from all over the world and put it together in a menu in a kind of our own way of sharing the diversity of different cultures around the table.
So how did the new menu that we're talking about here today, the menu that features food from countries that are a part of the current travel ban, how did that come about?
Well, we went into work on Monday, which is our typical day off, to do schedules and ordering and menu planning and different administrative things like that. And being exhausted from the week before.
From Devour Downtown.
Yeah. And we were sitting there and we were kind of down on ourselves for the fact that we were so busy. We're sort of isolated in our own restaurant. We missed the Women's March. We missed the protests at the airport on Sunday. And, you know, we were looking at a way to do something that, you know, within our small business.
Right. So food, you know, is a natural, obviously. So how did the menu come about?
We decided we wanted to do something with food from at least one of these countries, and my sous chef, Myra Church, kind of took it from there. She Googled the list of the countries and sort of wrote each one down, and we began to research, you know, dishes we wanted to do from each country.
So, Myra, how did that go? What were you thinking when you were, you know, finding out about the dishes and how it might fit into a menu at the restaurant?
Well, it's pretty amazing to work at Marrow because we have so much freedom to be creative, and with global as a descriptor, like, we can do anything we really want to do, so that's super exciting for us as chefs. And it's also something we haven't done a lot of, cooking. You know, this type of cuisine is not something we're super familiar with, but it's also a challenge, and the flavors and the spices from these regions are really incredible. And
so this is like the Arabian Peninsula, Peninsula of the Middle East.
Yes, parts of Africa, Sudan, Somalia.
So tell me a little bit about some of the dishes and what you found out about them as you, you know, were looking for them. You know, why one dish and not another, you know?
Yeah, well, we were looking for things that obviously would work on our menu, that we would be able to execute and find the right ingredients for. You know, like one of the first things we found is a Libyan dish called shakshuka, and it's a sort of a spicy tomato and pepper sauce where you poach eggs in it and you dip bread in it. And we're like, that sounds fantastic. You know, like, we can definitely do that. You know, when we looked into the Sudan, we saw that their pretty much staple diet crop is sorghum, and they eat a lot of the sorghum porridge.
We work with sorghum a lot already, and we're like, well, this is brilliant, so.
And we really got to have fun with that.
Yeah.
You know, we cooked the whole seeds. We ground some into a flour, incorporated in the porridge. We used a local sorghum syrup in there, and we needed a new foie gras dish anyway. And I like to go towards the breakfast side of pairings with foie gras. So, you know, it's a seared piece of foie gras on top of sorghum porridge with a sorghum and tamarind sauce on it. We also discovered that you can pop sorghum like popcorn, and it makes tiny little popcorn. So
really,
we just, you know, it just turns into playfulness in the kitchen and having a lot of fun with it.
So what other kind of dishes are there? I see the one from Yemen, which sounds like something that people might be somewhat familiar with. It seems like a very well-known dish.
Yeah, that one looked like a great entree for us, a chicken mandi. So it's a chicken that's marinated with like saffron and garlic, actually marinated with butter, which, I just got that marinated yesterday. It smelled fantastic. You know? It's got like baharat spice and dried lime. And we're going to, they usually bury it in pots and cook it with a fire like that, but that's not an option for us. So we're going to smoke it a little bit and then kind of braise it and try to get the flavors as, you know, accurate as we can.
Now, what about the drinks? Do we have a focus on that as well on a menu?
Yes, definitely. You know, John and Myra, we're at the restaurant on Monday. We're usually always down there together. You know, I was home getting some stuff done, and John sends me over, you know, the picture of the menu and the idea, and he's like, hey, you know, this is what we're working on. And, you know, it really kind of got me inspired in that. So, you know, I started... My background, I went to school for economics, so free trade and that is huge for me, and the flow of trade and that. So one of the coolest histories of drinks, I think, is the mint julep. So it actually was based off of a Middle Eastern cocktail of rose water, rose petal and water, and usually medicinal alcohol that made water more safer and palatable. And then through trade routes through the Middle East, that came to Europe, where mint was substituted. Then it came across the the ocean, and then we added bourbon to it. So,
oh, that's fascinating.
This classic American cocktail is, you know, started in this culture. So I did my take on that. It's a julep, and it's got rose petal, bay leaf, malic acid, gin, and hibiscus in it. Really great flavor, very tea-like. So definitely. So I've been working on ideas with cocktails to pair with everything here too as well.
We've been talking about activism and food with Chef John Adams, sous chef Myra Church, and bartender Charlie Shoemaker of Marrow in Indianapolis. Dishes from the countries affected by the recent White House travel ban are currently on the restaurant's menu. For more information on menu, go to marrowindy.com or look for it on Facebook. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and we are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, ready to talk about this weekend's big event. And it's not the Super Bowl. No, we're ready to talk craft beer with Brewers of Indiana Guild Executive Director Rob Caputo. Specifically, we're talking Winterfest, the sold-out craft beer festival at the Indiana State Fairgrounds this weekend that expects to draw 7,000 attendees who'll be able to sample beers from 101 Indiana breweries. Rob fills us in about the festival, now in its 9th year, and what attendees can expect.
All the festivals that the Brewers of Indiana Guild puts on are basically fundraisers for our organization. So we're a 501c6 not-for-profit organization. All of that money comes into the organization and basically goes back out to support our membership. So at this point, it's 135-plus breweries. So it's a moving target. I wish I could give you an exact number, but we have a brewery and planning membership, and I just picked up three of those this week. So there are a lot of breweries in planning. But basically with Winterfest, it's a fundraiser for our organization. Part of all of our festivals, that money either goes back into our political action committee. So some of your ticket price goes to that. And then these festivals were also designed, because we're a not-for-profit, to give back to the communities that we're actually in. So, for instance, $3 of every ticket at every one of our festivals, right off the top, this isn't based on revenue, goes straight into our actual charity partners' pockets.
So Winterfest, the big brewery festival, yep, that's always this time of year. So it has a lot of moving parts and a lot of goals. Now, this is the 9th year,
yep,
for it. How is attendance? Probably sold out, right?
Yeah, it's, yes, sold out. And, you know, every year we try to make it a little bit better. Sometimes bigger isn't better. So we've tried to, this thing started in a much smaller pavilion at the State Fair and has,
right,
worked its way up into a much larger space. And then this year we have a much larger space.
Oh, my goodness. So it has continued to grow over,
yeah,
the years.
And some of this has been, we're tied to dates. So we've got the home show that we've always fought against and a hockey game now and that kind of thing.
A lot of things to work around.
Yeah. Well, actually, this year moving it a week is probably going to help some of the logistics for the folks coming onto the fairgrounds, because the home show's done. So we're not going to be competing,
right,
for parking and that. And then the building's just got a lot more natural light. All of the breweries will be in one building instead of two buildings, which, is
very
a
nice
little bit of a logistics challenge. And it's allowed for a different layout that should kind of create a little bit more equity of line instead of having people bunched up against the wall.
Tell me, how many breweries are going to be at the fest?
Well, last year we had, 77, 78. This year we have 101 Indiana breweries.
Indiana.
Just,
oh, my goodness.
Indiana. You'll see some tables from the local distributors who are supporters of our members, so we always try to include them. We've added some what's called a sprinter booth, so you'll see some standalone brewery booths, and then some of our distribution partners will have some specialty booths as well that have a particular type of beer, sours, barrel-aged beers, that kind of thing. So,
mm-hmm,
it's one of those things where we're trying to create a little bit different atmosphere there and then, give some people some more space if they want to, come in and have that. And hopefully for a festival goer, it'll make a little bit different experience than we've had in the past. And we've tried to do the same thing with our summer festival as well, try to spread that out and get some activities going. So
now you also have meads this year, some meads and a local hard soda. What other sorts,
yeah,
of things do you have?
So it's interesting with the cider and mead is considered wine by permit here.
Right.
So they fall under the wine permit.
So they're not real, they're not beer at all, but yet they tend to align themselves with the breweries.
Yeah, and a lot of them do that because the non-wine folks, particularly the mead folks, view themselves as more of a batch manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we have a lot of our breweries that swap barrels with some of the local mead, wine, cider folks. And we've always had one or two there. This year, I think the end of last year at Microbrewers Fest, we had five or six, and we've got the same this year. And then we've got a hard soda company that's based here out of Indianapolis or Indiana. They're going to be bringing some things in. So we're trying to expand that a little bit just to see how it goes, see what,
mm-hmm,
what it is. Offer alternative beverages for folks that don't necessarily like beer or maybe are gluten intolerant or whatever.
Right,
but
all,
it's also
all
about
of those
us
things,
including other elements of Indiana and other businesses that basically are doing something similar to us.
The craft beverage community.
Yep. And then we, unfortunately with Winterfest, we're tied a little bit to the fairgrounds, but
right,
we also, work to promote. A lot of our members use local hops or local coffee or whatever. So we try to promote businesses when we can and try to get them involved that actually utilize our members' products and their products, or utilize their products and, you know, a coffee maker's products and a
beer.
So there's a lot of trying to create some synergies with some other support organizations or groups or businesses, and that's kind of what we've tried to work toward.
Now, do you have regional beers as well, people from coming in from outside the state?
You know, this year we actually is probably the first time we've ever not had, like, independent breweries coming in, because we've basically added another 23 Indiana breweries on top of last year's.
Well, that's kind of a good problem to have, though, that you've had so much growth among Indiana breweries.
Yeah. We've got a lot of new folks coming on that maybe aren't used to the drill, and we've tried to make the registration process a little bit easier. And then, of course, some people wait till the last minute.
Of course.
This year we've been able to accommodate everyone, but if the industry grows to 170 breweries, it's going to be more of a first-come, first-serve.
Tell me and explain for maybe people who aren't familiar with Winterfest what exactly it is, because this is big.
Yeah. Right. The nice thing about Winterfest is there's not a lot of other crazy festivals going on this time of year. So it's a good opportunity for everybody to take a break from winter and enjoy some craft beer and focus this on Indiana product. And we started this thing, you know, Microbrew Fest is, what, 21 years in. So we started this festival with the intent of kind of giving folks a break from winter. And, again, this does benefit our organization from a, you know, fundraising perspective. But, you know, part of it was, let's break for winter. We've got a lot of folks who have different beers now than they would in the summer. So, you know, summer you might have a bunch of wheat beers, wit beers, fruit beers. And we've got a lot of folks with, you know, really nice stouts, dark beers,
right,
higher alcohol beers. So
right,
it's a different, completely different, for the most part, lineup of beers.
So all these breweries from all across the state are here. Now, can you try everything you want to try? Are there, you know, amounts or tickets or limits?
Well, you're going to get a taster cup, and you're going to get a 2 to 3 ounce pour in those. I would encourage people to hydrate and don't try to drink everything in the first hour. You know, from my perspective, I always say you got to be a trotter, not a thoroughbred. Pretend you're one of those pacer horses. Pace yourself through it. Take a break if you need to.
And I suppose you should take a look at who's there and which ones you really do want to try.
Yeah, and there's a map in Nouveau this week, a public map, and that'll be available there as well. But, yeah, you certainly should map that out. We're trying to get our members to be better about getting us their beer list. But, you know, everybody's got their favorite brewery. A lot of people bring very, very specialized products to these things, too. You know, a rare keg, whatever that is. So, you know, some of the folks that are your favorite breweries or other breweries that you've heard of or have seen the list, I definitely would have a plan for the early part of the festival.
Okay, so that's important is to kind of figure it out ahead of time, right?
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, if you're in as an early bird, so you're in an hour before the general admission folks, try to bop around and catch it, because at some point some of these beers will run out based on the number of people versus the amount of beers. Honestly, with social media now and the ability to immediately text someone, you'll see these kind of crazy little runs on a beer when somebody texts somebody.
Oh, absolutely.
Also standing next to somebody and talk to them, and then they text their friends. So it's kind of weird. You'll see some people wait in line for a time tapping, but it's just kind of interesting. I think social media has kind of changed a little bit of that aspect, or the ability to text people.
Now that, you know, that's very interesting that social media has effect within a festival, not just to promote a festival, but within the actual experience itself.
Because people basically post a beer type thing, and there's other people who are following along with the fest, and we may actually be walking around ahead of the festival or during the first hour, and we as a guild may be tweeting out through our account saying, hey, or, you know, whatever, posting something on Instagram.
Right. This is interesting. Take a look at this.
Yeah. And some of the, what happens is, you know, the friends that aren't, you know, friends that are there may tell the folks out there either on social or text or whatever, but you see a lot of this kind of thing getting posted up there, and, you know, the breweries are posting things as people come up, and, you know, so there's a lot of interaction. And honestly, the early part of the festival is the best time to meet the brewers and hang out with the brewers.
Now tell me how many people you expect for the event.
You know, I think our tickets are around 7,000 for this one.
7,000?
So, yeah.
That's a big festival.
It's a big festival. That doesn't include brewers tickets and what have you. So it's going to be a good chunk of people in there. But again, we've added close to 20,000 square feet in one building, which definitely changes the dynamic. The last couple of years, we've had two relatively square buildings with pods, and this one is one very long building with all of the booths down the center. So it's,
oh my goodness,
everybody's lines run out towards the walls, and it's, you know, so I think it's going to be much easier for people to negotiate that. There's some cut-throughs through each one of these pods of booth spaces, and then there's a few things out around the outside. But hopefully the flow will be very, very good this year.
We've been talking with Brewers of Indiana Guild Executive Director Rob Caputo. We'll be back with more from Rob about craft beer in Indiana here on Eat Drink Indy Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are talking craft beer today here on Eat Drink Indy Radio with Rob Caputo, Executive Director of the Brewers of Indiana Guild. And there's no doubt that craft beer has taken off in Indiana, particularly in the last 5 to 10 years. We now have more than 130 breweries operating in the state and more in the process of opening. It's the dream of plenty of home brewers and craft beer fans, but it definitely isn't easy. Rob tells us about the realities and challenges of the current craft beer scene. I want to talk a little bit about the state of craft beer in Indiana. How would you characterize that?
I mean, I think we're doing well. I think you see that with the breweries that, you know, the fact that we're up to 135-ish plus whatever breweries. I think what you're seeing, though, is that's changing from the types of breweries that we have. So there was initially the brew pub guys that kind of got this going, and then you had the proliferation of production breweries, and Right. Now we're kind of back to that neighborhood pub, partial brew pub kind of thing. So these, you know, it's kind of...
Oh, that's interesting.
It's kind of come a little bit full circle.
It's interesting.
You know, if you look at the market, though, I mean, I think the craft, I think the number I heard the other day is, you know, 4%, less than, you know, 4%, a little less than 4% of the total beer market here. So, you know, when you're talking about saturation or have we hit the, you know, bubble, consumption would say no. I mean, I think Indiana's, you know, top 20 as far as number of breweries, but consumption were like, you know, late 20s, early 30s. So consumption pattern here versus number of breweries, that's, you know, there's a big disparity between that and the state as opposed to other states.
So I think that what people are seeing is just that there's a lot of breweries. They're not seeing that there is so much room to grow on the amount of beer that people drink. Is that right? Amount of craft beer.
Yeah. And if you go back and look at, you know, pre-Prohibition times, you had a lot of these breweries that were in small towns and every little town had one. And I think if you're in Indianapolis, it kind of gets a little distorted because of the number of breweries that are here. But you've seen a lot of newer breweries open up in underserved areas that have been relatively successful the last couple of years. So, you know, some of this is about, you know, location, location, location. So
right.
would I start a production brewery here? Maybe, maybe not. Depends on what my outcome is, because shelf space is obviously more limited and we have more and more bigger out-of-state breweries coming back to the state and taking up shelf space. But, I mean, if you've got a little fairly high traffic neighborhood spot and you put in the right business model, I think you can be successful and you're doing quality beer. And, you know, so some of this is a little bit of that, you know, having the right business model, sticking to your guns,
right,
and then not trying to bite off more than you can chew. Just be who you are and don't go, hey, I've been successful, I need to be something else. And I think a lot of people deviate.
Or try to do everything.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, can't be all things to all people.
Now,
sure.
Now tell me the differences when you said production brewery versus brew pub, that sort of thing. So explain that just a little bit.
Well, the brew pub folks are going to have a restaurant, and generally those two are linked together. The laws here have always... There were really no laws until 93 about that. So there was initially a brewery and a restaurant. But those places are you've got a restaurant and you've got a brewery and they're tied together. And essentially it's depending on what your goal is, you're either a brewery that happens to supply food or you're a restaurant that happens to supply beer. Some people do a good balance of that. But,
right. So yeah. The beer that's made supplies the restaurant and that one space.
Yeah. Then you see the production breweries, which are generally looking to distribute. That's mainly their model. And they may have a tasting room or a tap room there. Some of them may be putting in a kitchen or whatever, but their primary focus is on distribution.
We're talking breweries like, say, Sun King, for example.
Yep. Yeah. And then you've got a bunch of people in between. You've got some of the folks in some of these cases that may actually be considering putting in food. You've got some of the newer folks that are little smaller breweries, nano breweries, you know, smaller system that may just not have a restaurant and... still being successful and doing a basically small production model. And then you have some of those that have a small production model that also have a kitchen and are offering a, you know, menu of maybe 10 items.
Right.
And, you know, so
it really does vary.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, the difference, you've got some people in the state that may be doing, you know, 15 gallons, half barrel of beer, basically up to folks that are doing, you know, 30, 50 barrels at a time. So, you know, there's this widespread. And as an organization, the Brewers Guild, you know, we've got to, you know, we're working on legislation or we're working on any kind of program for our membership, we've got a very, very broad base of people to try to get, you know, keep happy or make happy.
Can you pinpoint a time when it started growing?
You know, probably, I want to say 3 to 5 years ago. So, you know, right after Sun King, there was kind of a big kick up of production breweries. And what I think you've seen is that you've still got a couple of people that may be coming into the market or considering doing something where they're distributing. Proliferation of mobile bottling and canning has got some smaller breweries that are, you know, saying I'm going to package, but it's not their primary goal. So I think, probably 5, 6 years ago, this thing started to happen. And then what you're seeing is there was that big push of craft brewer, you know, of production craft breweries. And then now it's kind of like swung the other way. Hey, I'm going to put in a small system in a small neighborhood type pub. And what we're seeing now is more and more small towns with that kind of return to the local brewery.
Now, you're right. So, recently a brewery opened in Shelbyville, mm-hmm. right? We've had seen them in Greenfield. So small towns
are... You ever been to Leoto?
I have not been to Leoto.
They have a brewery.
So now, isn't that awesome that, yeah. that the smaller towns are you know, embracing this?
Yeah, and I think it's kind of a return to our, you know, pre-prohibition roots. And I think that's how come when people are talking about the saturation point, you may have a particular market that seems... like it's kind of reached its max, or, you know, maybe I wouldn't start a brewery here. But, you know, across the state, there are just all these underserved areas. I mean, if especially on the east side of the state. I mean, if you go out to Richmond, there's 3 breweries out there. And then down in Aurora, closer to Cincinnati, there's a brewery. But other than that, if you go basically east, there isn't a whole lot.
So when we see, you know, when we get the feeling that there's an overabundance of breweries, or that surely, you know, we've reached our limit, maybe we're just seeing central Indiana.
Correct. Yeah. And I think that. I mean, I know there's a couple of places that are in planning up in Lafayette. You know, you've got a handful of breweries in Bloomington right now. Columbus has got a handful of breweries. And, you know, perhaps they can support 3 breweries or 4 breweries. You know, here in Indianapolis, if you just look at the entire, you know, outlying area, I mean, there's still some places that probably could use a brewery or could take a brewery. But, you know, when you're here, you're a little bit jaded because you're like, geez, you look at a map and you see all these breweries. If you look at the rest of the state, it's pretty scattered, you know. So it's interesting. It just depends on how you're looking at that, whether you're looking at purely at numbers or if you're actually looking at where they actually sit within the geographic, you know, locations within the state.
Now, do you expect to see more of the very small breweries, like, oh, say, Cannonball Brewing, that opened at, you know, 17th and Bellefontaine in what I would imagine would be an underserved neighborhood, mm-hmm. for breweries? Very, very small, but with very good food. Do you see a future for those kinds of places as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you're going to see those. If I'm in a small town, that's kind of what I'm going to set up. You know, you got to look at who else is in the town. You don't, you know, if there's a bunch of chain, if there's a chain restaurant and then the cafe that closes at 2, maybe you offer an alternative dinner, you know, nice dinner option. So some of it's going to be dictated by that. You know, food will generally keep people in the seats a little bit longer. So I think some people are making decisions based on that. But I think you're going to see more and more of that. I think the initial investment to get into that's different. I mean, you're going to probably spend some money on a kitchen. But at a certain point, you just say, again, who am I? What's my model? And as long as you stick within that model, I think, you know, you're fine if you can build up a good regular clientele and people are get good service and get good food and get good products. So, you know, some of this comes down to quality as well. I mean, I don't, you know, but at the end of the day, I think you're going to see more of that.
We've been talking with Rob Caputo, Executive Director of the Brewers of Indiana Guild. For more information on Indiana breweries, news, and events, plus the new Indiana Beer mobile phone app, go to drinkin.beer. Well, as we get further into February, you know what that means. It's not much longer until Valentine's Day. I hope you've made your Valentine's Day dinner reservations and won't be waiting until the last minute. But one thing I found out in doing our series on local chocolatiers is that people do wait until the last minute to buy chocolates for their sweetheart. So even though chocolatier Julie Bolchak of Chocolate for the Spirit has been encouraging her online customers to order early, she knows she'll still be scrambling to fill last-minute orders. Julie, who recently closed her brick-and-mortar shop in Carmel to concentrate on online sales, explains what a chocolatier is up to during the build-up to Valentine's Day.
Tell me what life is like in February for a chocolatier.
Well, the thing is, for Valentine's Day, unlike the holiday that we went through for the winter holiday and Christmas and all that, which goes on for weeks, where people purchase for multiple people for multiple reasons.
All through the season.
All through the seasons. Valentine's Day is just a singular day, okay? Not as many people are purchasing for Valentine's Day, but the ones who are, they want to have whatever they've had from you in the past that is their favorite or their loved one's favorite.
Right.
They want it exactly for that day, all freshly made, beautifully packaged in your best packaging, and all ready to go for them to descend on you at the very last minute, no matter how hard you have tried to reach the people in advance and
right.
say, please help by pre-ordering. That helps me to schedule things.
Sure.
It doesn't work that way.
It's last minute.
So exactly. So just as a matter of fact, this past weekend is when I started making what we will call my Valentine's Day chocolates, okay? And I today did my first shipment, and I'll be shipping daily. And, you know, it's all freshly made, and it'll be good for then. But I expect next week, despite the fact that I have done my best to inform people that I do not have a brick and mortar anymore,
right.
okay? And how to get me, I will have these panicked people who will say, I went and you're not open. Where are you? Help. And so then we'll probably be doing some combination of maybe an all-nighter, some last-minute packaging, some urgent shipping, and probably driving into the Indy area to meet up with some people because we don't want to disappoint.
So now that brings up the subject of the brick and mortar. So tell me how this what's been going on through the last few months as you close the brick and mortar to focus on online.
Well, what I've done is I have explored every muscle that I have in my body, okay? And I've forgotten about several of them because December 23rd was the last customer day at Chocolate for the Spirit at our Carmel location.
Mm-hmm.
And so I closed that down, and I had had two brick and mortars, and that was the last one. So we closed that down, and then we had 1 week to move everything, and I had a lot of stuff, to move everything out of there and take it to my, you know, my property in Shelby County. I have a big property there and everything. And I have a studio there that I had not used in 3 years.
Since you opened the Carmel location.
Exactly. Right. So, you know, I had to move everything. We had all this heavy equipment. It's no secret. If people know us, they know this. We're not spring chickens, okay? And so my husband Dale and I did the majority of this moving. It was absolutely insane. And
right at Christmas time, right?
You know, in between Christmas and New Year's, and thank goodness for the most part the weather was decent. But, you know, we hauled stuff to property, and then we had to go into the studio and revamp it. And we have been hauling stuff because it's a second story.
Right.
Who needs a Stairmaster? and then the other thing is just finding my things.
All your stuff now.
Just finding it all. So I still have a few things that I'm looking for. Okay.
That have disappeared.
That have disappeared, right? And, you know, one wants to not go buy something that they know that they have.
Right, it's here somewhere.
It's somewhere. So we've had some interesting fun with some of that and some lessons learned that I can offer moving advice. And unsolicited, I actually have offered moving advice on the social media to people about, you know, some tips when you move, particularly as it relates to electronic components and things like remote controls.
Right, because you have a lot of stuff. You know, you had a lot of stuff in the production area of the chocolate shop, and now it all has to go back into your studio. Right,
right. Well, and in other areas.
Does it all fit back in?
I have a lot of things for sale because the retail area, I have three large chocolate display, you know,
right.
cases that are refrigerated and lighted and all for chocolate, and a gelato machine
that.
So I have all of that.
So that didn't come out of the studio when you opened the shop. So that was new. So it doesn't fit back in.
No,
right?
We have a three plus car garage that you cannot move in.
Okay.
Okay. But, you know, after I get done with Valentine's Day, we'll, you know, reach out to the world and find happy homes for all this stuff so we can recover our garage space again.
So that's what you've been doing since Christmas. But as you gear up for Valentine's Day, making the things, what's a day like? And, you know, what are you making?
Okay. Yesterday I started at 4 a.m.
Oh my goodness.
Okay. Yeah. Get the temporary machines going. I have over the past weekend made some things. So I printed orders off. I started to assemble items for the orders while I was waiting for the chocolate to get tempered so I could make things. Yesterday I probably made about 600 truffles.
Oh my goodness.
And finish them out and cup them up so that I could start putting them in boxes for shipping. And, the day just goes on. It goes on. And, you just don't know when it's going to end. And it'll be like that, you know, until we get through Valentine's Day and come up for air. But I've also created new things because why make life easy?
Right.
Why make it easy?
But you have a set lineup, like you mentioned, that people want. You know, that they probably want their favorite things.
Yes.
You know? And so you're continuing to expand that line,
though. You know,
it's
silly
Valentine's
me.
Day.
And I tell people when I travel, you know, I brought my tools with me that I use, and they look at me because I'm standing there, and I raise my hands up, and I say, here they are. They go with me everywhere. So I am an artisan chocolatier, okay? And primarily everything is made by me. I get a little help every now and then, but at this point it's mostly made by me, packaged by me. My choc doc, though, husband, is the bar wrapper because nobody, including a machine, can wrap a bar as beautifully and consistently as he does.
Very nice.
So he wraps my connoisseur bars for me. You know, I have over 85 different original creations. So anyway, so we've, you know, got new things in mind. And I have already explained to people that I have a collection of 16 very unique pieces. It's called Women of the World Collection.
And each chocolates, right?
Of chocolates, mm-hmm. Right. And each one of the chocolates is going to be my gourmet homage to a famous woman in history, and through either flavor, color, or form, tell a bit of a snippet about them so that hopefully people will say, oh, I didn't know that, and then maybe they can learn a little bit more about them.
Oh, how very cool. So that's one of your new lines.
That's new, and I plan to have that available starting next week.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, including a few things in there that I've not made before, so cross your toes.
So you are continuing to grow your product line, but tell me about the product itself and what you do work with, because this is not your run-of-the-mill chocolate.
No. Okay. So I'd traveled and I tasted really good chocolate. And I come home and I would see chocolate everywhere, the chocolate that I grew up with. And it is a commodity or candy grade. Okay. Most of it is adulterated in some way with oils to extend it, with artificial flavors or whatever. And, you know, people, when they think of chocolate, they say they like chocolate. Really, most people in this area still are thinking of it in terms of like candy.
Right, like a chocolate bar you pick up at the drugstore.
They think of it as candy, mm-hmm. Okay? But there's a whole other world to explore. There's over 400 flavor and fragrance aromas found in cacao, okay, that can be turned into chocolate, most of which people in this area have not experienced because what they see locally is this commercial grade or chocolate.
Candy bar chocolate.
Yeah, candy bar chocolate. Exactly.
And so that's what we're familiar with.
Right. And so what I'm working with is what's called fine flavored chocolate, and it's in this very unique wheelhouse. Some of what I work with, only 1% of the cacao grown in the entire world is of the quality to be used for that particular chocolate. So that's what my interest is, okay? And I'm a niche chocolatier.
Sure.
I'm a niche chocolatier. You know, we don't yuck anybody's wow, and you know, we're not opposed to enjoying what we have, you know, typically available to us, but personally I like to explore unique things and have a unique experiences with all kinds of food, not just chocolate.
We've been talking with chocolatier Julie Boljak of Chocolate for the Spirit. We'll be right back with more from Julie on how she decided to become a chocolatier here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. What would you do with your life if you could reinvent yourself? Study something new? Learn a trade? Start a business? Well, local chocolatier Julie Boljak of Chocolate for the Spirit did all of the above. When the former IT executive was laid off from her corporate job, she already knew that she wanted to switch gears completely and focus instead on chocolate. In fact, she wanted to work with some of the best chocolate in the world. And so in 2009, she launched Chocolate for the Spirit. I talked with Julie recently to find out just how it all happened. This was something that you decided to do as a midlife career change, right?
You're right, yes. I was in the IT world, and I managed big IT projects, multi-million-dollar global virtual IT teams and large implementations. And through my work, though, in the corporate world, I was able to do some traveling and to be able to experience what I call really, really great chocolate.
So a little perk of the job, getting
absolutely
to travel around the world?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so, again, you know, I would come home and I couldn't find the same quality. So I began having chocolate shipped into me from some of these other people for my own personal enjoyment and for gifting.
So you started as a fan of fine chocolate.
So I, you know, I explored it and I was aware that there was a different quality that was available, and that's what I personally enjoyed. Well, as we go along into the corporate world, I went through an experience that I'm sharing, though, you know, with many others, and that is, as you get a little older in life, and we talked about, you know, getting the gray hair, people start to look at you just a little differently and thinking, you know,
right,
maybe you've had your time here. You should move along, okay?
Ah, right. So you face that in the corporate world.
Absolutely,
right.
Yes. And at the particular time that I experienced what was called riffing, reduction in force.
Layoffs,
exactly,
sort of
layoffs. Yes, I had actually successfully implemented a very huge project for my Fortune 50 company and was expecting to get my next big assignment.
Sure.
And I got the word that that I was being, you know, let go.
Oh.
Okay.
Harsh.
But then the next day was actually offered another assignment for considerably less and more responsibility.
Of course.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Okay. So what did you do at that point?
Well, I had already started to work with chocolate. And
just on your own?
Just on my own. And I'd started to work with chocolate and had an interest in it. So when I got that letter, I really thought, do I want to go back and just continue to experience more of the same? Or am I going to take a leap of faith and go forward and work with chocolate?
Well, now, tell me how you got to deciding about wanting to work with chocolate. You went away and really thought about this,
right? I did. I had been really literally in the wheel working many, many, many hours and canceled a lot of vacations and not really a lot of time to think about what I was doing, just constantly
just
reacting
doing
to the demands of
sure
the job. So I did take a break and I went to Sedona, Arizona, which is known for being somewhat of a spiritual kind
sure
of thoughtful retreat place.
Mm-hmm.
And
now, this wasn't a long vacation.
No.
This was just a few days.
It was a few days, exactly. But I participated in a creativity seminar.
Okay.
And in the course of going through that seminar, I realized that there was a creative side to my persona that I had really been, you know, setting aside in order to keep up with this corporate thing. So as I sat under the beautiful blue sky surrounded by the red rocks of Sedona, for anybody who's been there, you'll know what I mean. And if you've not been there, go. And I just started making a list of my interests and the word chocolate just kept coming back to me.
Really?
So I had never really made anything in my life.
You'd never been, like, been in food service?
No,
you'd been
in
the corporate world, right?
Exactly, yeah. So I decided that I would become an artisan chocolatier.
You just decided.
I decided I would be an artisan. I have all these notes from this, too. So I decided I would be an artisan chocolatier, and I decided that I would work with some of the world's best. So I decided from the beginning I was not going to be a candy maker and candy manufacturer.
Okay.
So I decided that I was going to do that. And at that very moment, then I also named the company Chocolate for the Spirit.
Right there.
Right there.
In Arizona.
Because now think again, I'm in this spiritual kind of environment.
Sure.
Okay. And I'm, you know, this was also during the time when we were experiencing recession in our country and things were a bit dim. I liken it a little bit to maybe the kind of mood we have now. Okay.
Oh, right.
A little dim. Okay. So I thought, you know, this will be something that I can dive into to not only lift my own spirits, okay, but hopefully the results of what I do will lift the spirits of others as well. So that's why it's named Chocolate for the Spirit.
I get it. How very nice. But I'm still fascinated at the idea of just choosing to do something completely different.
We all can choose every day. You can wake up, you can go to bed tonight, and you can wake up tomorrow, and you can choose to do something different if you want to.
Well, but
that's what exploring a passion is all about. I mean, you really take into your heart, okay, that you have a commitment to something and you're going to do it. Okay, and it doesn't have to be the way that I've done where, you know, you put all your eggs in that basket. But all of us need to have some aspect of our life where we're doing something that we would do with if there was no money involved, if there were all kinds of obstacles in the way, we would find a way to go over them, under them, around them, because we have that passion. You know, many of us, I'm a mom, and many of us as parents have had those moments, you know, with our children.
And pouring that into
pouring that
the
into
family.
The children, right. Right. But, you know, my nest got empty, and so, you know, I was looking for some way to explore that aspect of myself in another arena, and this is where I'm at, and I'm committed to it.
Now, what did people say when you said, as a former IT executive, I'm going to be a chocolatier? Was there a reaction?
No.
People didn't say, oh, you're crazy.
No. First of all, I have a really supportive husband, and at any moment that I ever even thought that I was going to question it, he said, do it.
That's great. Right.
And
there.
I didn't ask anybody's permission. You know, we all come from different places in life and have different personality styles. I'm not one who is looking for everybody to approve and using that as a basis for what I think I need to do, you know. I'm not trying to do anything that's going to harm anybody. So, you know, I sort of have some little rules of the road. But I don't look for everybody's approval.
So you were okay with just shifting gears completely? I mean, these are the sorts of things people dream about doing.
Well, I became a student. I mean, immediately, because think about this. When you start just starting any kind of a business up, you have all these things that you have to figure out. Okay, you have to have a logo, you have to have a brand. Are you going to have a website?
All
you know,
right.
All
hear,
of the financials,
so
the LLC, or you know, how are you going to organize and structure? So there's all those things to do. Plus, I was an artisan moving into a craft where I already tell you, even after all these years, and this was 2009. You know, I still have a huge bucket list of things that I want to do that I've not yet done. So, you know, I was just totally busy every day, not enough hours in the day to spin all of the different plates and that I needed to move forward in this. And it's really been like that ever since.
Now, what's ahead for Chocolate for the Spirit? You said you have a bucket list and things you still want to do. I would say that the business has been successful so far. And now where are you going?
Okay. Well, I've made a couple of decisions. One is that I no longer want to have a brick and mortar.
Okay. Now, that was a goal for a long time, was to have a brick and mortar, right? It seems like for a lot of small businesses, that's the goal.
It wasn't an original goal. As a matter of fact, I originally said I was not going to. Okay. I was not going to, but then some things happened and it seemed to make sense, and so I did that. Okay, and I've had several people lately approach me with various offers
that sound enticing
and et cetera, and I have declined those. What I am going to do is spend a lot of time this year developing my website. Okay, and I have the website now, and it works for me, but there's a lot that I need to do to be able to, we'll say compete. That's not a bad word. To compete more in that space with some of the heavier hitters, okay? I'm going to continue to do education. I want to talk to people about cacao, and I already said in some other conversations that I'm really worried that if we don't get people to understand what fine-flavored chocolate is and what the difference is and demand it, that we might lose it. So I want to get that word out to a lot of people, okay? I plan to do some traveling and working with some other chocolatiers and people in the food business, doing some collaborations, okay? You know, when you're tied to a store or brick-and-mortar location, you know, you can't. It's very difficult to get away.
Sure.
So now I almost feel like, take a breath.
A little freedom.
And again, I have that long list of things that I want to explore, including getting some really fine flavored beans in and doing some more bean to bar. And then this Women of the World collection that I'm working on, I'm very committed to it, not only for the experience from a culinary perspective, but also because I just think that there are achievements of people that, you know, we need to be mindful of and reminded of. So I'm hoping through chocolate I can do some of that work as well.
We've been talking with chocolatier Julie Boljak of Chocolate for the Spirit, part of our three-part series on local chocolatiers. For more information on Julie's artisan chocolates, go to chocolateforthespirit.com or look for it on Facebook. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2, The Point. Thank you for supporting local food here in Central Indiana, and thanks also to our guests today, Chef John Adams, Sous Chef Myra Church, and bartender Charlie Shoemaker of Marrow in Indianapolis, Rob Caputo, Executive Director of the Brewers of Indiana Guild, and chocolatier Julie Boljak of Chocolate for the Spirit. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio.